Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 24 with Irish international show jumper, Clem McMahon, recorded at his home, Hilton Farm, in County Monaghan, Ireland. For almost the past 30 years, Clem has been a consistent competitor and winner on Ireland's National Grand Prix circuit, and a five-star Nations Cup winner with Team Ireland. In this episode, we discuss the standout ponies and horses throughout his career, the highs and lows of a life in horses, what Clem looks for in a young horse or a foal, as well as breeder partnerships, and of course, we discuss his own phenomenal partnership with the great late Pacino, and why 10 years to the week of Pacino's passing, why the future for Hilton Farm is looking so exciting. The earliest record I can find of you competing starts in 1994, but that would put you at 18. So I'm wondering, what was your involvement in horses or ponies prior to that point? Because the first record showing up was 1994, riding Hilton Gold.
Yeah, no, it started an awful lot longer before then. My mum and dad were involved in horses heavily, and my mum started to teach me to ride, I'd say, when I was about 18 months old. Then would have done hunting. I actually done some carriage driving. And
competitively?
Yeah, I drove at the indoor Dublin show when I was probably 5 years of age. I was probably back in about 81. But then started jumping fairly soon after that. I think my first show jumping 12-2 ponies was six, when I was six. I remember winning the 12-2 CD Winter League final the first year Cavan Equestrian Centre opened in 84. And from then, like, you know, when I was probably 8 years of age, I would have had six or seven ponies going to each show. And we produced our own ponies. And I was lucky enough, my dad especially was a very good judge. Had three very, very good 12-2 ponies that was bought relatively cheap at the time. I think the three of them maybe cost £900. And bought a little Cyclone, Have a Go, and Dusty Bin. And they qualified for Dublin. Went to Scotland, jumped teams in Scotland in Ennis, and had really good success. And those three 12-2 ponies actually sort of bought half the farm that we're in here now. So we are. So
that's incredible.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, there was a lot of ponies put through our hands. I was really, really lucky also in 13-2s. I had probably one of the best ponies that was ever about, or a pony called Mr. Polo. My dad bought it off Cameron Hanley's dad. You know, at the time, was a bit of a gamble. Like, you know, we weren't wealthy people, and, you know, he cost enough at the time. But he was a very, very good pony. He was an albino pony with blue eyes. And Cameron had jumped him just up to grade A, although he was only probably, I think, six at that time. So I took him over, and we had a great time with him. He won Dublin, I think it was about 88, and I think was second in Dublin in 89, and then we sold him to people in England. And he's very successful in 13-2s, and when they were finished with him in 13-2s, they actually moved him up to 14-2s. And he won a silver medal in the Europeans. He was a very, very good pony. So yeah, there's been lots of ponies now, I have to say. And started riding horses probably when I was 14. There was a show in Navan at the time. It was a nice memory that the same day I won the 138th Grand Prix, and I also won the BC final on a horse. And Yeah, it was good memories. And second in the Grade E final, so it was, you know, I was lucky. My dad was sort of always on the road and always keeping his eye for horses and stuff. The first horse that I sort of jumped was a horse called O'Mara, and he would have won Dublin again, the Young Rider Championships and stuff. He was a really competitive horse.
Do you remember where he came from? Or?
Yeah, dad bought him off a girl up in Derry. I think he was jumping D&E classes at the time. He was probably 7, and he was a good transition horse from ponies into horses, and he was second in the Young Riders in Hickstead. He won Dublin. You know, he was a good little horse. Now, so he was.
And at that stage, say when you were either in ponies or coming out of ponies. Were your parents involved in horses full-time already at that point, or did that come later?
No, Mum and Dad was always involved in horses. My dad, he would have dealt in anything from driving horses to hunters, jumpers. He had a couple of point-to-pointers. I remember going to the point-to-points when I was probably 3 or 4. So, you know, it was horses all the time. With a small horse transport business at the time. And then when I started to ride the ponies, my dad would have bought a lot of ponies. At the time, there was a good trade for ponies going to Sweden, and there was a lot of ponies bought and sold on to Sweden. So it was a business quite early on, in, you know, from you were probably 10, 11, you know, you were producing ponies you know, trying to make a good job of them to get them sold, and that's the way life was, you know.
There's probably two elements of that have been of great benefit then, because you were probably riding all sorts of, you know, ponies from green ones to ones with a bit more mileage, and I'm sure easy ones and tricky ones, and you probably had to ride a lot, but also from a very young age, there was a constant reminder of the realities of the business side of this.
Yeah.
The horses kept moving, or the ponies kept moving.
Ponies kept moving. There was a lot of ponies, what we would call trade ponies, and for sure you got used to riding good ones, bad ones, hot ones, cold ones, you know. And, you know, even riding, people sort of say, oh, you should always try and stay in the better ones, but you learn something about ponies or horses riding all sorts, you know. It definitely, you know, probably sets you up for later in life, some of the ones you shouldn't be buying, you know, because, you know, you sort of take a look at, like, why was that difficult to ride, because, you know, it was made this way or cantered that way, or, you know, it's you know, every day is a school day, and, you know, you can learn stuff riding the normal ones and the bad ones also. But I was lucky enough that the few good ponies that we were sort of jumping at the higher level, you know, they normally stayed until you were finished in them. Yeah. So I had the 3 12-2s up until I was sort of nearly ready to come out of 12-2s, but then was lucky enough to have 13-2s. And again, they were kept until I was finished 13-2s. Probably the weakest batch of ponies that I had were the 14-2s, but, you know, they were quite good too, you know, so they were...
But at that age, you were probably already transitioning into horses, were you?
Yeah, I started, you were riding horses at home, probably since you were about 12. But I started competing them when I was, 13, because I was still in 13-2s when I started jumping the horses. So yeah, but I have to say, I got to the stage where I couldn't wait to actually get away from the ponies and just ride horses. I just really preferred riding the horses to the ponies.
And can you explain why?
I don't know. Maybe the 14-2s weren't the strongest bunch I had. So, you know,
we were less just, enjoyment.
Yeah, you know, we were always very competitive. And, you know, that the 14-2s won lots, but still, I suppose maybe when you get to a certain height, you do prefer sitting on a horse, maybe that was it. But yeah, I got to the stage where I just couldn't wait. I was actually out of ponies at one stage, you know.
Had you a competitive spirit at that age?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. You know, you were just... That was the way it was. You know, you tried to win. You know, you're probably less competitive now because, you know, you're thinking of the production and of horses. But, like, out then, like, you tried to win every day, so you did, you know. And, you know, we were lucky and we did have a good run in the ponies now, so it was successful, yeah.
But then your success continued on, like you had a good young rider career, and actually even looking back through your record, it was great to see that one of your early days young rider horses came from beside us at home.
Yeah, Hilton Clover, he was bought in Gores Bridge back in, I think it was 92, and I was still in ponies, and Dad seen him that day. And took a liking for him and bought him. He was 3-year-old unbroken. And he turned out a very, very good horse. He, you know, won a lot of Grand Prix nationally. And no, he was a bit of a sharp lad, so he was to ride. But that's probably why he actually ended up staying longer with us than some of them. But he won a lot of national Grand Prix, that horse, yeah. He was very competitive, very careful. And he actually jumped the Grand Prix down in Mill Street when it was a proper World Cup show for like one down. So like he was a fighter. That was, you know, a real fighter.
And then you had a European outing, did you, in the young Rider Institute?
We went to the Junior Europeans in 93 in Austria.
The juniors, sorry.
Yeah. And Jerry Mullins was chef to keep for us then. He'd done a great job with us. And probably, you know, looking back, the horse I took that time, you can dress it up whatever way you want, but he wasn't good enough, you know. He let us down badly, and never forget, in the team event. So you were sort of a little bit coming home with the tail between your legs a little bit. But, you know, it was a bit of a reality check, you know, to be a judge of what you have and what you need or what you should be looking for.
So was it more a motivation than a deterrent?
Probably was, yeah, it was. And, you know, Jerry being the chef to keep, Jerry didn't dress it up either, you know what I mean? Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point in being surrounded by yes men, you know, or, you know, telling you what you want to hear. So basically had to sort of look out for better horses then, you know, and... It's funny that week that I got home from the European Championships, I went down to a sale in Gores Bridge, and I was there on my own. Mum and Dad were actually driving the truck back from Austria, and it was just meant to be. There was a 3-year-old there by the Joker. She was a bay mare, short tail, something had eaten her tail, and she was quite poor. And but anyway, she jumped very nicely, she did. So I actually bought her, and that ended up to be Joker's girl. And you know, she was obviously only 3 when she was bought. She done a little bit as a 4-year-old, not too much because she was weak and backward, but she was good in her young horse classes, 5, 6, 7. And she actually, as an 8-year-old, done the internationals in Dublin, and jumped clear for a time fault in the Grand Prix. And I think she finished 7th or 8th that day, which was my first time to ride at the internationals in Dublin. And the game seemed simple back then because, you know, first time in internationals in Dublin, jumped the Grand Prix clear for a time fault. So you start to think, oh, maybe this is going to be easy. But no, it's definitely maybe was beginner's luck, but it was a great day. But again, that mare was sold within 2 weeks of Dublin show being over. So, you know, she was gone. So
yeah.
It was just the way it was. Like, I was only 21 then when that. And, you know, you would have loved to have kept her because, like, you're after jumping around one of the biggest Grand Prix in Europe. But Musto was a great master, and she had to be sold, and that was it. And that was the business.
At that point, was it clear to you, like, at what point, rather,
was it clear that you were going to pursue horses full time, or was there ever any doubt about you doing anything else?
Sort of before then, I really liked school, and you know, I enjoyed school and was good at school. But once I got the Leaving Cert done, I didn't plan to go to college. It was straight away into the yard at home. And I suppose at the time, I was lucky enough that I had two what looked good horses, the Hilton Clover and Joker's Girl. They were both young horses at the time. So I suppose they were a good motivation to get stuck in and get them produced. And so, yeah, college was probably never an option. And so then you sort of have to make the best of what you have. And there were two good horses to be working with. But then probably, you know, Joker's Girl was sold in 98. And then in turn, I got a bursary to go training in Europe. And that was in 99. And I went over to Bate Manderley. And was really enjoying that there, because at the time, Bate was going really well. He was just back from the Olympic. He had a horse called City Banking, which was a class horse. And he had another very, very good horse called Pozzitano there at that time. And just the way he rode, it was a great experience, and was really enjoying it being there. Steve Gerder was actually training with him at the same time. And he was just a really good trainer, but I was only there probably 2.5-3 weeks, and then got a phone call from home that that dad was quite sick and had cancer, so sort of had to come home. So it was a case you play the cards you dealt. It had to be done, and that was it. But you would have really liked to have spent more time there, but it wasn't to be, you know.
After that point, did you ever get another opportunity to go and base yourself somewhere else, or?
Yeah, back in 2000, my dad passed in July, and then Dublin show was obviously in August. And at the time, just the horsepower wasn't brilliant in the yard. And the opportunity came from Jan Tops to go over and ride in Jan's, and all was organised, and it just probably came a bit soon after my dad passing, and just it didn't suit things at home at that stage. So I had to then say no, and you know, it's probably one thing that you just, you know, when you're looking back, you just wonder what if type thing. But again, circumstances, it wasn't to be, and so that was it then. It was home.
And I suppose at that point where it, you know, it was clear this is what you were going to be doing full time, you're saying you had a competitive nature from a young age in the early days in the ponies. But had you a clear goal as a rider, what you wanted to achieve or what you wanted to become? Like, did you have set ambitions at that point?
Well, when you were young, of course, that, you know, you think of championships, Olympics, and doing the big shows, whatever. But sometimes reality just doesn't allow that. And, you know, you would have loved to have done the bigger shows. You had a belief in your own ability and everything else. But at the end of the day, you know, you had to produce, you had to find the horses young, you had to produce them. And unfortunately, you know, to keep the wheel going, you know, you just couldn't sort of say, well, I'm just going to keep this and go and do the bigger shows. Back in 2001, I came across a very, very good horse called Looks Good in Switzerland, and a really, really good jumper. And some people came in and bought him with me, and I produced him for probably about 15 months. And again, looked like a Nations Cup horse, proper 5-star horse. But offers came on the table after Dublin's show in 2000. He jumped the 7 and 8s there. And then he was sold to the people who own Spruce Meadows. And he went on and done some very good things for them. And again, looked like a horse that, you know, would probably bring you to the biggest shows. But yeah, that's, he was sold. But, you know, then after that, I was lucky enough then to get two horses, Gelvin Clover, and another horse called Hermes de Reeve. And I suppose Gelvin Clover was maybe the first horse then that wasn't for sale. Robert Scott owned him from Derry and had no interest in selling them. And so for the first time, I had a chance then to put those two horses together, Gelvin and Hermes, and actually make a bit of a plan and go and do some of the shows that you wanted to do. And so that was back sort of around 2003, 2004, 2005. And I have to say, really, really enjoyed it. We jumped Rotterdam, Falsterbo, Hickstead, jumped the Aga Khan with Gelvin Clover. I think it was about 2004. Unfortunately, that day didn't go to plan. It was probably the most, it was the most difficult day in show jumping for me. It's funny the way it works. He jumped the big class on the Wednesday, and he actually jumped very good. He was clear, didn't jump the second round, said, I was told I was on the team. But obviously he'd done something that day, because when he was warming up on the Friday, from early on, you just didn't get the right feeling. And he ended up, he had 12 and 12, you know, just first time Aga Khan team in Dublin. It's just, you know, it was
deflating.
Yeah, it was, no, because you knew you were better than that. You knew the horse probably was better than that too, but just, you know, that was the last day that horse actually jumped for maybe 18 months. So he, you know, he wasn't right. But, you know, Nations Cups, the worst thing about it is, if it was a Grand Prix and you 3 down the first round, at least you were finished. But my God, to have to go back in the second round again, it's, yeah.
And it has an effect on more than just yourself. At least with the Grand Prix, if you have a bad day.
Exactly. You know, you feel, you know,
is yourself.
Yeah, you feel you're letting down a team, you know, it's in front of the home crowd, you know, it's something you've dreamt of going to do. And so, yeah, it was, that was a difficult day.
What was he like as a horse, actually? Because it was one of the things I was thinking about asking you this evening. He was probably one of the last full Irish drafts, or registered, like Irish drafts,
yeah,
to perform at that level. And also then he went on and like bred some useful horses, the likes of Superchild.
Yeah, he, Gelvin Clover was a very, very good horse. Although he was like full Irish draft, he didn't look like a draft. You know, he had less bone, he was lighter, he had a wonderful canter, really, really good canter. And one thing I have to say, he had a serious heart. He was such a fighter, you know. Like hand and heart now, with having rode other horses, probably didn't have the scope to actually jump the 160s. But, you know, he had the heart to do it, you know. And then as a stallion, like he didn't really get a chance, because he didn't actually cover a mare probably until he was, I'd say he could have been 10-year-old before he covered anything, and never covered many, you know. And but the few that he did cover, you know, he actually bred well. Like Superchill was a very nice horse, won the 6-year-olds in the RDS with Greg, and looked very impressive, and then was sold to America then, and done some good things in Grand Prix out there too, you know.
How did you come about getting Hermes?
Hermes, I had bought a couple of horses off Niles Halbert in Switzerland. The Lux good horse came through Niall. And then I was over looking at some younger horses, and Niall just had this, he was a just turned 8 at the time. And he says, I have a really, really good 8-year-old here. But he was expensive. And I had, you know, I didn't have sponsors at the time. And he says, sure, have a sit on him anyway. So I jumped this horse and he just jumped absolutely class. He did really, really good trial. Probably the most careful horse I've ridden, or one of the two most careful horses I've ridden. And then I got speaking to some Swedish people, and I was lucky enough that they actually came in and bought Hermes. And I think he was bought maybe February time. Come June, we'd won a 5-star Grand Prix in Hamina in Finland. He was so competitive. Probably not the last scope to jump the proper 160s, but any 150 class at any of the big shows, you know, he could win. He won classes everywhere, and he was national champion in 2000, and I think it was 2005. I remember he was late coming out that year, and he went to Oma show. He won the Grand Prix in Oma. He went to that was probably June. He went from there to Balmoral, won the Grand Prix in Balmoral. Then he went to Blessington. He won the Grand Prix there. Went into Dublin show. First day he'd won down. Second day he was second in the big class. He won the Mini Grand Prix on the Saturday, and went round the Grand Prix that year for a foot in the water and one down. And then our national championships was probably about 10 days later. He won the first day, won the second day, the third day. Like, he was just such a competitive horse. And, you know, when you had him good in the ride and soft, he could win at any show in the world, so he could. But probably just didn't have the last scope. But no, and he was a very lucky horse to fall upon at the time.
Because was it those two horses? Would it be fair to say that they got you nearly a name for riding stallions? Because it seemed then there was a line of stallions then from that point on started coming into the picture, and some for longer than others. Or had you been riding stallions before?
No, the first stallion I probably rode was Arkansas, and he came in 2001, I think it was. He won the 4-year-olds in Dublin that year. Marley and Susie from Suma Stud had brought him in from VDL, and I really liked him. He was, again, a very well balanced horse. Really good technique, good from the floor, but probably, again, just not last scope, you know. But like, he won the 4-year-olds in Dublin. He won, at the time, was probably the biggest 5-year-old class in Ireland at the time, the Cavan Classic as a 5-year-old. And then he was in Dublin as 6, and then he went back to Holland then as a 7-year-old, so he did. But he was probably the first stallion. And it's just, I suppose, it's just the way it happened. Gelvin came, Hermes. You know, it wasn't the case that you were actively going looking for a stallion. But, you know, they were good horses. So, you know, you sort of, you liked them. So, you know, I've always been the whole way through that, you know, if an owner was to bring a horse to me, you know, if I didn't think that the owner, that there was a good future in the horse, you know, you'd sort of say that to the owner. And if you didn't think that the owner was going to get paid at the end of the day, like, there's, you know, there's nothing worse than an owner paying and paying and paying and then having nothing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that doesn't sit with me. So, you know, I would try and tell them early on, well, you know, he's a nice horse, but I don't think he's good enough, or, you know, maybe, you know, he's not the one to be spending all the money on.
If it was at the moment and an owner was to to give you any stallion that you haven't been involved in over the years, if you could have any stallion that's currently out competing in the world to have the ride on now, is there one that sticks out in your mind that you'd love to have for a season or for the rest of their career?
Stallion wise, at the moment that's jumping, probably not. I'd probably pick a gelding called Sir Edward, or you know, instead, you know,
the King,
or the King Edward, even. Yeah, he's a freak of nature, so he is. It's, you would hear, you would still love to be doing the biggest shows in the world. So if somebody was to, yeah, say there's a couple of proper 5-star horses, yeah, no problem.
Never know who's listening.
You never know. You never know.
Have you a favorite type of a horse? Like, if you, when you're going out looking at young horses, you know, you're at foal sales, you're sometimes at the 3-year-old sales, or you're out at young horse classes, right through to international classes. When you're looking for a horse for yourself, have you a favorite type, or have you specific things that those horses have to, like boxes they have to tick?
Yeah, I would say that there's certain things with horses I wouldn't entertain at all. I really, you know, for me, they have to have a good canter. They have to have a nice active hind leg. You know, it's funny, you do learn through your own mistakes and definitely through your pocket. Like horses I would have bought 15, 20 years ago, I definitely wouldn't even dream of buying now. Because, you know, you find out, you know, definitely why are some horses nicer to ride? Why are some horses more difficult? A lot of it does come down to the way they're actually made. I don't like horses with a really high head carriage. I don't like horses with a stiff hock or an inactive canter. I don't mind a normal walk. I don't mind a normal trot, but they do have to have a good canter. And then, you know, people say, oh, you want a really big, tall horse because, you know, but that's not necessarily, you know, you like to have a horse with, having ridden so many horses that actually are a little bit short of scope. You know, you look to see, well, why are they short of scope? And it's normally because it's the way they're made, you know. You know, for me, I think it's the freaks of nature that can actually jump to big tracks that are only 16 hands or something like that. So I do think the horses, they have to be, you know, what's my ideal horse? A horse that's 16-3, 17 hands. He's light. He's blood. He's got a good balance. He's made the right way, that the neck and the head are where you want it. You know, that they're not going to be, you know, against your hand. You know, then they're, you know, if they're made the right way, they're easier to ride, they're easier to work, they're probably easier on themselves because they're not putting extra pressure on different parts of the body when you're trying to get them to ride the way you want them to. And then what are you looking for? You're looking for a horse that's blood. He has to be careful. He has to come off the fence himself. And yet have the scope that he can jump big fences without, you know, some horses can actually jump big fences by traveling forward all the time. But what you nearly need is now is like quiet backward scope that you can actually, you know, you can sit and not have to be running to the fence, that they can push themselves, you know. So it's, I suppose you're looking for so much. That's why there's so few horses in the world that actually can do it, you know.
But with some of those, with say the physical attributes that you were describing there, just thinking of it from a breeder that's listening, a lot of those physical attributes are probably traits that are already evident as a foal as well.
Definitely. I have to say, I remember I was doing a couple of shows in Europe back in around that 2004 time, and I stayed in Hans Horn's yard for 10 days or so, and just talking and listening to Hans, unbelievable horseman and such a good judge of young stock. Like the time Jos Lansik rode for him before he left for Sangerside, he had the most incredible team of horses from Lianas that ended up at Pessoa, Easy Jumper, Libro H, probably three other 160 horses that were all bought as foals, you know. So that's, you know, you might buy one and be lucky, or two, be very lucky, but luck doesn't come into the equation when you can have such a string of horses bought as foals. And like just getting talking to him, like, you know, why did you pick them as a foal? And actually, one day he went looking at foals, and I went with him. And I learned more in that one day than I probably had in a lifetime about looking at young stock.
What stands out actually from that experience? Is there anything that...
It's actually just how they're made and how they balance themselves. Like, if a foal canters with his head up and his back down, like, he's going to do that as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old to the day he dies, you know? If he has the hind leg stuck out behind him, you know, that's, you know, I don't care what type of rider you are, you can't alter that. So, you know, it's to sort of, to see that foal cantering in front of you there, and to, you know, imagine him then as a 5 or 6 year old, and what's he going to look like with the tack on him, just the way he canters there now. Is he in the right shape? Is he, you know, is he going to be in balance as he canters down to the fence? Like, if a horse is out of balance before he leaves the floor, there's no chance of him actually making a good shape over that fence, you know. So yeah, it was a lucky day that I bumped into Hans Horn.
You've met a lot of breeders over the years, and through buying horses or being out at events, I suppose you've been exposed to a lot of breeders over the years, or them coming to use stallions here. And you made a few interesting comments when you were asked to speak at the National Equine Conference in 2013. And there's 2 points that I want to touch on, just to get your views, because it's 10 years on, and I just want to see if your thoughts are the same, or if they've changed, or how you see things now. You gave the example of going to Gore's Bridge, of getting the catalogue, going through all the horses, all the 3-year-olds that were entered over that day, and that the realities were, before you even went and looked or pulled out a horse, that there was only about 8% of the catalogue at that time that would even interest you in going to have a look at. That you felt that there weren't enough breeders breeding the type of horse that you as show jumpers were going out looking for. In the 10 years since then, do you feel there's much change, or how is the picture looking for you?
Yeah, I don't actually remember saying that, but I take it at face value from you.
As in, is the selection?
Yeah.
Is what's being bred, or the selection of horses that you're seeing available?
Yeah.
Is it more desirable 10 years on?
Gore's Bridge has changed a bit in the last 10 years. The boutique sales, say the Going for Gold and Monarch and a few other sales, have taken, this is for the 3-year-olds now, has taken probably a good few horses out of this what used to go to Gore's Bridge as 3-year-olds. So again, when you go through the catalogue, there probably isn't that many horses that you could sort of think there's a possibility here. But the foal sales has definitely improved. You know, I have to say, you know, the pedigrees are a lot stronger. There's a lot of imported semen now into this country. So yes, it has definitely changed with looking through the foal catalogue. There's definitely more foals you would be sort of interested in looking at.
Yeah.
But maybe the 3-year-old hasn't changed as much, because they're now going to the more select sales. And, you know, I think there's more of those horses maybe not getting to the sales now that look good, that maybe they're going into the production to be produced on instead of being sold as 3-year-olds as well.
Yeah.
But I have to say that, you know, the foal pedigrees have improved a lot in the last few years, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting point that you made was around the foals and maybe seeing the dams at the time. Like, again, this is 2013, and just that in a lot of cases the dams that you're seeing with these foals weren't up to scratch, the type of mares that people were breeding for. Like, obviously at the time you were acknowledging there obviously were good breeders breeding good horses, but just a lot of what you were seeing, the mares weren't, in your opinion, up to scratch at the time. But you said a line that I actually wrote down because I thought it captured it really nicely. And it's about people's broodmare. If she's too far away from what you're trying to breed, well, she's obviously the wrong mare.
Yeah, that might come across, maybe people think that's harsh, but I would still stand by it.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't change my opinion on it because, you know, if she is that far away, like, you know, what's the point? Like, you know, I don't think, you know, it's going to be a money earner for the breeder. I don't think they're going to get a lot of enjoyment out of what's coming. So, you know, change your direction and, you know, even say that mare, the way things have gone with embryo transfer, get an embryo and use her as a recipient could be the best job, you know.
Because I actually didn't read it as harsh. I actually thought that it was a really nice and helpful way of seeing that put, because there's only so much and with any combination that you can possibly fix. So if there's 20 different things wrong with the mare, what stallion can save her? Whereas the better the mare gets, the less the stallion needs to actually bring to the table. And I think you also mentioned at the time, you know, if it was a mare that maybe the shortcoming was that she just maybe didn't have the last scope, that was a lot easier to add in. And there was actually an article appeared recently I was discussing with a friend where the guy that was asked in the interview kind of on this topic felt really with any cross, there's only one thing that you can probably fix or work on at a time. But I actually thought that was a nice way of putting it, because if there are too many things that you need to address with your mare, you're playing the lottery.
Mm-hmm. You're basically hoping for a freak. And like, really, you can't really be aiming to breed freaks. You know, that's just not possible, you know.
Are breeder partnerships something that interests you or that you still do here?
Big time. We've been very lucky there with a few breeders there. John Connolly,
yeah.
He had a mare back in 2000 and I think 13 or 14. She was a Cicero mare. She was, she came in on a share with myself and John. We took an embryo out of her to Demont. She would have been, I think, third in the Boomerang final as a 7-year-old.
Yeah, I think in I was Mill there Street, that day, yeah. Yeah.
And then she was sold to America. That embryo that was collected from her ended up to be TGM Amorfur, that ended up jumping 150 Grand Prix this year. What was second in the Premier Final in Mill Street? Sorry, in Mullingar. Won the Grand Prix in Cavan in September, and now he was sold to America there just before Christmas. Another one that was very successful for us was Hilton Up the Banner. It was bred by Ger Kelly. He came to me as a 3-year-old. We had an agreement. I produced him as an 8-year-old. As a 7-year-old, won the 7-year-old Grand Prix in Spain. Jumped his ranking class as an 8-year-old. Placed in up to 150 and again sold to America. So it's I look, you know, I have no problem at all doing a partnership with someone that is on the same wavelength as yourself. Here is, you know, it's a place for your horses to be produced and ultimately sold. But I have to say, with, you know, the likes of John and other people I work with, you know, if one is broken and I ride it and I'm just not getting the feeling that I'm really enthusiastic about it, that I think it's going to, basically what we're trying to aim is at 7-year-old, that this is a 140 horse plus. if you think it's not going to reach that level, it still might be a very, very good horse and do a very, very good job for a lot of people. But maybe just not to that level. Well, then we would sort of maybe sell that earlier on. If they're a real blood type, maybe they're for the event route. I try to think that starting off with a 3-come-4-year-old of the feeling that I'm getting off it, that you'd like to think it's going to be at least a 140 plus horse come 7-year-old. That's the.
And is there a preferred way that you like to do those partnerships? Or say, I'm thinking to the breeder out there that's sitting there looking at their nice 3-year-old, trying to come up with a plan for this year. What's your preferred way of working those partnerships?
There's different ways. You know, you have to remember that if you take on a horse there that you think is good there at 3, but you really, you know, he could be the type that you think he's going to be 7 or 8 before there will be a customer for him.
Yeah.
You know, you have a lot of expense from, you know, you have 4 years there. So that's obviously more different than, say, somebody coming to you with a 6-come-7-year-old that, you know, he's closer to the money. So that, you know, it's all different, but, you know, you have to be fair to the breeder. You want them to earn money too. You know, there's always more horses. There's always more time. Like, you know, I see some people and it's, you know, it's just make everything on this one. It's wrong, you know, and it's wrong on the breeder. It's, you know, I try and think of, you know, it's better to have it long-term than these short-term things. And, you know, you like the breeder to be happy, enjoy it, earn money at the end of the day too as well. So that's, you know, that's why, you know, I've owners for so long. You know, you like to think that you do the right by them, you know.
Yeah. Talk to me about your first introduction to the Chino. And do you remember the moment when you heard about him? You would obviously have had good success with his brother Hermes.
Yeah.
How and when did you hear about Pacino, and talk to me about the first time that
I was at the show in the Odyssey in Belfast, and Hermes was jumping there, and James O'Grady was over. He's based in Belgium, and he was over for the show, and he said to me that he knew of a 3-year-old that was out of the same mother as Hermes, but was by Demont. And once I heard, you know, when I heard Demont, my ears really pricked, because Hermes was a very, very good horse. He was by Quito de Bossi.
Yeah.
And Quito probably was a little bit of a disappointment of a stallion. He won the World Championships back in Stockholm. But again, probably just didn't give them the most marvellous canter, which probably, you know, curtailed Hermes jumping the bigger tracks too. So anyway, Demont, you know, he had, you know, jumped at the top level, World Championships. People were starting to talk a little bit about, you know, the offspring. So once I heard about him, I went over very shortly then to Belgium to have a look at him.
Was he still with the breeder at that point, or at some?
No, he was with the breeder. He was with Frans van Meert. And certain horses just stick in your head. Like, I never forget the first time we just went, small yard, this, looked over the stable door and saw this beautiful head or whatever. But when he took him out, like, the presence of this horse, and he trotted him up, and like, this horse, just the way the power from behind, the hocks working, you know, loose through the shoulder, beautiful head, big front, just looked, you know, beautiful type, man. Beautiful. Just the way everything worked on him. This is only, I hadn't even seen him to the fence yet, you know, just the way he trotted up and down. You know, it's in all the horses you see in all the years, you just don't see this too often, you know, just that model and just the way he was so active, such an athlete. So then we jumped him loose, and he was really fresh, and to be honest, nearly didn't give himself enough time at the fence. He was so blood. He was very, very quick from the floor, but and looked very, very careful, but just a little bit too fast at the fence. But seen enough that, yeah, we'll chance you, Suiva. So he was bought. That was probably February of his three-year-old year. And he came home. We broke him straight away because he was a big, tall blood horse. So, you know, you can't really go throwing him out in the field either. He's a stallion, so he was broken straight away. He was got riding. And the balance of this horse, from word go, like, you know, he was only riding, but just everything came so easy to him. The canter was just class, you know. Carried himself. Like, this is a horse, he's 17-1, a three-year-old, and he carries himself like a 16-hand horse, you know. That's six-year-old, you know. He's and beautiful mouth, snaffle mouth. But just when you sit up on him, like, he was just in a shape. He was in the correct shape. It wasn't that you were trying to make the shape or anything like that. And I remember giving his first jump just along the side of the indoor, and just little small, little vertical. And the feeling he gave me at it, like, it didn't make sense that this big horse could come off the ground as quick as he did. Just so, so quick from the floor. And then you're sort of saying to yourself, Jesus, is this horse scopey or not? You know, because he was so quick from the floor. And but then, you know, horses of his size just don't normally come as careful as him. And then, you know, a few more jumps and then he relaxed a bit and then the scope was easy. And so you were very, very happy. Yeah, you were more than happy. You were saying that this is just different. So he's only three at this stage. So, you know, I'm not a big, I don't talk horses up. He was then obviously then come sort of summertime, he got out into the field there and stuff. So only a long story short, the first show he done wouldn't have been till July the following year in Tattersall's. And he was a ball of energy like that day. Like, it was his first time away from home. I remember Tattersall's has actually ended up to be the most perfect spot to bring him because you could go off around the cross country. He just so much energy. I was probably on him for an hour before he even went into the warm up. And it was, you know, in the warm up, he could be a little bit quick at the fence. But I don't know, as soon as he went into the ring, he was never rushed. He always backed himself off the fence. And if you had a seen the exhibition he put up in the ring, that, you know, it was ridiculous. It was, you know, he came down to the first little oxer fence one, and the people, you know, you hear people say, oh, he went over the top of the uprights, but he actually did go over the top of the uprights. And I've still a video of it, you know. And, you know, okay, some jumps, you know, not, it was first day out, not the perfect shape, but just so much respect for the pole, so, so careful. And as I say, horses with that scope just don't come with this level of carefulness. And so yeah, it was the start of just an amazing journey.
And how clear, because he was still only a complete baby, he was a four-year-old, you can dream, but it sounded like from the get-go it was clear that this horse was in a different,
it was league. Just I go on about the carefulness, like, you know, as I say, just repeating myself, you know, he was 17 at this stage, he's probably 17 two or three, and he just did not touch timber. And if he even just glanced off a little pole or whatever, you know, such a reaction. And like, as a four-year-old, he probably only done three shows. He went to Barnadon, And it was the national championships in Barnardown that year. And jumped the 4-year-olds there. And never forget, at the time, I was so disappointed that he was only second in the 4-year-olds, because I thought, you know. But back then, I don't know why you were, I suppose you were trying to get people to realise maybe how good this horse is or could be. And whereas now, it wouldn't bother me as much now. You know, where horses are placed in classes, you know, you go by your gut feeling and your judgment and just produce it the way you want to. But one of the turning points that really just a little bit cemented the idea, I'll never forget, in the following September in Cavan, the 5-year-old class was he was in the final, and in the jump off, he never went against the clock in his life. But I remember there was the first two fences in the jump off, I think it was like in the first round, it was like a little bit open 6, but he could hack down on 5. And you know what, it was funny, he was early to go in the jump off, and then there was another long run down to a double, 2-strided double, and I was too long down to it and too long going in. But like the way he backed himself up off the second part, like, again, big tall horse, never went against the clock in his life, you know, most horses would have ran into the second part, you know. And then I had another horse in the final as well, called Cool Isle Clover. And from 1 to 2, like, Pacino had done this 5-stride so easy, and I thought, I should just do the same in Cool Isle Clover. Well, I ended up absolutely falling through the second fence, you know, couldn't get there in the 5, you know. So, you know, it just, now and again, just it's something, you just get a different feeling of a horse, and you don't get it too often. But he was the one, yeah.
Yeah, and I think probably more so from the 5-year onwards, I'd say the rumblings were starting in the industry. You know, people talking about this young horse that you had. It was probably, I suppose, maybe a lot of people hadn't seen him as a 4-year-old. If he was,
yeah, I suppose he hadn't done so much. He actually, as a 4-year-old, he would have covered maybe only 8 mares. The next year, few more again, but never covered a lot probably until he was seven.
Seven, yeah.
But like, you know, his production just worked, you know, as a 6-year-old, again, didn't do a lot of shows, started doing his 130s, but just giving you the right feeling all the time. Was second in the 6 and 7-year-olds as a 6-year-old. And then as a 7-year-old, and you never felt you were rushing him, you know, 6-year-old on 130s, 7-year-old he was doing 140s, but like, he was popping around the 140s as if they were 120, you know. So, you know, I remember Balmoral Show, it was in the old showgrounds, and there was a premier there at 150, and like, you know, you were sort of saying, he's only 7, but like, he's doing it so easy. So anyway, he jumped to 150 in Balmoral, finished second as a 7-year-old. Done it so, just so easy, and just, you know, just simple, just canter up, small little bit of room, you know, and he just made it easy for me. And then I think he was placed also in Cork in the Premier, 150. I forget where he finished, maybe 4th, but again, double clear again. Then won the 6 and 7-year-olds in Cavan that year. And then his last show, and I think this is where people really, maybe further afield in Ireland, took notice. He jumped the international show in Cavan in November. It was live stream, so it was. And I remember he was first to go in the Grand Prix. And it was a decent track now, especially for a 7-year-old. Good 145, very, very technical. And he popped around it as, again, 120. You know, rarely do you get a feeling of a horse to jump that size of a track with you having to do as little or put as little pressure on him. You know, I don't. At this, like he's jumping around this, and he still hasn't even got a bit of leg squeezed onto him at this stage after doing all this, you know. And like that show in Cavan, he jumped Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. He was double clear the Friday night, Saturday night, and then in the Grand Prix, jumped the first round, absolutely superb, class. And then I blame myself, I was just too greedy. He's only seven, but the competitive nature came in, and I had one down the jump off. Get where he was placed again, but I should have popped around for double clear. But that's when the phone really started to ring about him, and from Europe as well, you know. So yeah.
But had you made a decision, because you said the phone was going to be ringing a lot in the next 12 months period, but had you made a decision that he was just not for sale at that point?
To a point, unless. And you know, there was a lot of money on the table at seven, so there was, but I just knew. I suppose hindsight's wonderful, but like, I suppose you had it in the back of your head that, God forbid, he was to injure himself, do something, that he was a stallion, so you had something to fall back on.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that he was a gelding. You know, if he was a gelding, there's nothing sure he would have been sold as a 7-year-old.
Yeah, nothing but sure. He looked like he had unlimited ability.
Yeah.
He was by one of the leading sires of the world.
Yeah.
His dam had jumped 140.
Yeah.
She had also bred Hermes and Melito.
Yeah. You know, all he needed was luck to be on his side.
Yeah.
So we planned to, 8-year-old year, planned to go, or did, went to Oliva in February, I think it was. I think he jumped, he was there for, I think, 5 weeks. He jumped 12 ranking classes in Oliva and was placed in 9 of them. Was very unlucky not to win the Grand Prix, the big Grand Prix, the last week. The fastest time, last fence down, finished 4th. Went from Oliva, we went to Lumen in Belgium. He was 4th in the Grand Prix in Lumen. Then a show came up then in Copenhagen. It was, I think that was the order, 100% sure.
That was the Nations Cup day.
Yeah, I can't remember whether that was before or after Mullingar.
I think it was before.
It was before, yeah. So he jumped the Nations Cup there, and there was this one vertical under a tree and with shadows and stuff. And probably with greenness, he had that vertical down in both rounds of the Nations Cup. But, you know, I was very, very happy with the performance. And then he was, I think he was maybe 5th or 6th in the Grand Prix. I just forget where he was. But he was placed in the Grand Prix on the Sunday. Then we come home. We done the show in Mullingar.
Yeah, the international, yeah.
I tell you, after, and it was one of the best classes in Ireland. After Oliver, we came home and we done Louth County show. And it was such a lineup, I'll never forget. Pacino was 2nd, but Conor Swale won it on Lansdowne. Tollam Keane was 3rd on Warrenstown. And Keane was 5th on Blue Lloyd. Like, what a lineup of horses.
For a national
Grand Prix in Ireland, you know. I don't think you'll see the likes of that too often or again, you know. So yeah, that was another very, very, he was very, very good there as well. So then Mullingar, he won the Grand Prix in Mullingar. It was just lovely, so it was.
I watched that back, but it was as much afterwards when you were interviewed, you were talking about the horse. Again, I wrote it down because I wanted to kind of read it back, because at this point we'll say this is still only the May of his 8-year-old year. He was doing far more than most horses of his age, but he was still a baby in the horse world terms. But it'll just show you kind kind of where your mind was at and what you felt with this horse. You said, this horse is just everything. There's going to be no course too big for him. He's so rideable, he's careful, he's scopey. He can do everything, this horse. He's just the perfect horse.
Mm-hmm.
And the best was only yet to come. He'd already had a serious year for an eight-year-old, but it was only getting started.
It was, and I'd forgotten about that, but it's nice to hear it, and it's nice to have maybe said it before he actually...
Five-star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that at least you weren't codding yourself or fooling yourself or, you know, looking through rose-tinted glasses. That, you know, the feeling you were getting of this horse was just so good. And, yeah. So.
Because within probably 3 to 4 months of you making that statement, which, like, it's a big statement for an eight-year-old, you went and you jumped the Nations Cup in Rotterdam.
Yeah.
You jumped the Nations Cup in Hickstead. I'm missing one before
Fosterbow.
Fosterbow.
Yeah.
And you're on the winning team in Hickstead. And then you get the call up for the Aga Khan.
Yeah. I have to say, you know, Rotterdam, that was a major test because, you know, it's one of the biggest shows in Europe, and I'll never forget, he had to jump off class the first day, and I wasn't that anxious about the time allowed, because, you know, first day in, this, that and the other, but my God, such an exhibition he put up there, it was just, you know, it was ridiculous, it was, you know, it really was, and then, the way it worked then, that he wasn't on the team for Rotterdam. They decided to not use him because, you know, maybe his age is that the other. But anyway,
one horse. Should be reasonable.
Yeah. But then the morning of the Nations Cup, one horse wasn't just right. So then we were on the team. And he jumped incredible. Now, first round, he was a little bit green here. You can't be that.
An eight-year-old in a five-star Nations Cup.
And he had a time fault. And then he was unlucky to have won down in the second round. Probably, I was thinking too much at the time and had won down. But, you know, Rotterdam, that was a real test now, so it was. And he just, again, you're never anxious, you know. And then Fosterbow, he jumped a clear in Fosterbow. And then Hickstead. There was a bit of pressure on in Hickstead because just the way it had worked, I was last to go and sort of had a jump clear to force a jump off or maybe win it. So he jumped a really good clear now, so he did. And then I think it was Penelope then. He was jumping for France and she'd won down, so then he won it. And then it was all systems go for Dublin.
Had you jumped an Aga Khan since that experience with Galvin Clover? Had you jumped one with Hermes?
No, never, never. So it was, first of all, it was great to get another chance at it. And, you know, you were actually really looking forward to this one.
You were going with some extra horsepower.
Yeah, you know, you weren't.
No question of scope.
You weren't too worried how wide the oxer was coming out of the combination or anything else, you know what I mean? They could build. It's one great thing walking into a course to walk it, and you're not anxious really what the course builder has asked. You know, there's loads of times I've walked in to walk courses, and the first thing you look at the combination, and is it an oxer coming out, or is it one stride coming out to an oxer?
You're checking your life insurance policy in the
world. Well, you were just, you know, you sort of knew what you had or whatever, but no, you weren't anxious what was going to be built for you. And the day it went like a dream, an absolute dream, so it did. Warmed up class, you know, I was first to go on the team, and only a little bit of an anxious moment. You jumped 1-2 and then went down round the bottom of the arena, round the pond. And he just took his eye or he sort of, he put his eye on the pond and just was a bit anxious with the pond, ran to the fence tree. But other than that, that was...
strange, considering he was probably schooled beside a lake here.
Yeah, he would have seen plenty of water, you know, all the time, every day of his life. But, yeah, it was just an incredible day. Like, you know, it's... you talk about days you dream of and stuff, and, you know, probably at one stage you probably thought you would never get a chance at it. But to get a chance to do it with such a caliber of horse... was just, we were lucky.
And then, yeah, like, I think if somebody said it now that they were taking their 8-year-old to jump the Aga Khan, like,
yes,
it'd be quite the surprise. But to have a horse of that caliber to do it, as I said, back in May, you were saying, like, there's no course too big for this horse, but to go in, not just jump a 5-star Nations Cup, but the added pressure of being an Irish rider, jumping in front of that crowd. It's something that nearly every Irish rider aspires to do, is represent Ireland, jump the Aga Khan. But to go in there, do a double clear and be on the winning team, like, you couldn't write it.
No, you couldn't write it. You know, to jump a double clear and not win it would have, you know, it would have took away from the performance of the horse, but for the whole experience, it would have really taken away from it, you know what I mean? Like, to be lucky enough to be on a team that was capable of winning it, and you know, and everything that goes along with it, it was just class, you know. And it's a day that'll die with you, you know.
I watched back the round, but it was nearly as special watching when you had gone through the finish line, because for anyone that knows, you're not an overly emotional individual.
No.
But to see it explode out of you,
but it's
going around that arena.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is hard to get words for it. Like, you know, you've rode so many horses for so long, and just to be lucky enough to come across one that can be as good as that, like, really, I never thought a horse actually could be as good as that. When you get a horse with the scope like him, nearly always they're not the last careful. Or if you get a horse as careful as him, they don't have enough scope. And if you are lucky enough, you've both, well then, you know, are they difficult to ride? You know, he was so balanced. And
where was your mind at after that victory in terms of your career and your future together?
I thought, you know, a serious amount of fulfilment, I have to say. That we were able to find this horse, break him, produce him, and to end up at that level and get that result, you know, it can't get any better. So then, yeah, you do sort of start to dream and think then, you know, well, this is a proper Olympic horse, this is a championship horse. Then... one thing I was, we all know how it finished up, but one thing I was so happy was that, I know it was early for him to do it at 8-year-old, but I would have hated to try and convince people of how good he was if he hadn't have done that. You know, he died the following February, but if he hadn't have done that, I would have hated to try to sort of say to people, you know, he could have been that good. It was so nice that he had done it.
Yeah.
You know, that would have really galled me if, you know, if you're trying to sort of talk people into, you know, how good he was.
Yeah, well, at that point, I know we're talking, that's, let's say, almost 11 years ago, or 10 and a half years ago. But the chat even at Dublin and going around was, this is the best 8-year-old in the world.
Yeah.
There's obviously the rumblings of all the money that's been offered and turned down. It must have gotten fairly ridiculous at that point.
It did, yeah. He was going to change our lives considerably, you know.
And the next generation.
Yeah. Either sport-wise or financial-wise, you know. And it was funny that, you know, Dublin was his last show.
Yeah.
Our plan was that he obviously had done more than enough that year as an 8-year-old. So our plan was actually that we were going to freeze semen then come the end of August. And then unfortunately, Anne-Marie Jemison, who done all the stallion work for us, her husband passed away 2 weeks after Dublin. So we just sort of put it in the back. I says, here, just we give everyone a break.
Always been, next year.
Yeah, always next year. And then our plan was to freeze and then early part of the following year. And then January, we were starting to freeze him, and they'd taken semen off him. The horse was in work, horse in good form, whatever. And we took semen off him, and Anne-Marie said when she saw the semen, like his semen was always so good. And when they took the semen off, she couldn't understand, the semen is really bad. So then, you know, they thought, the first time they took semen off him, you know, we would, you know, must be something, you know, just do it again tomorrow. Yeah. Same thing again. So went down to the vets to get him checked out, and they took some bloods off him, and the creatinine levels came back absolutely sky high. And that was down in Fethard. Ger Kelly, Ger said, here, you may take him to a vet called Kevin Chorley. And he was up in Anglesey Lodge at the time, and he put him on treatment, but nothing was working. And we tried everything at the time. We actually even we'd heard that a vet had done a study in America by putting a horse on a dialysis machine. So we flew him in with his nurse and put him on the dialysis machine, and it would bring his creatinine levels down, but as soon as he came off the machine, it would just shoot back up again. So game was over, it was done. So,
and that's this week 10 years ago.
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was such a blow at the time. Like, it was just, it was crippling. But the only thing, he was good to us. He actually left some very, very good horses behind him. At the time, I had three 4-year-olds in the yard, all by him, which turned out to be Picato, Pacifico, Paparazzi. And they all jumped 160, 5-star. Paparazzi was placed in the Dublin Grand Prix as an 8-year-old. She was clear for a time fault. She was 7th. And yeah, she went to America, and no, he left some incredible horses, so he did look after me in the long run, you know.
Yeah. Financially and emotionally, it was such a huge blow. Like, it wasn't just
it was
one or the other.
Yeah, it was like,
and career.
Like, career, yeah, like you were going from
top of the world.
Top of the world, one of the best horses in the world. You know, you had a horse that the world was looking up to, or yeah, after, or, you know, like, you know, and, you know, you were covering lots of mares. He covered, I don't know how many that year. You know, all he needed was a little bit of luck. As I said, that's why he was there for as long as he was, that he was a stallion, that you were comforting yourself a little bit that, you know, if he gets hurt jumping, yeah. But to lose all, to have no barrels of frozen semen, you don't believe, you know, the nearly the predicament you found yourself in, you know.
And when he covered his first crop, as you're saying, the runny 8, you didn't know at the time, but looking back now, of those 8, there was such a high strike rate. Say 5 or 6 of those then gone on to have international form. But really, at the point that you lost them, it was only that, probably the season or two before, that he actually got any sort of proper numbers of support. Yeah. First 2 years or two or three years, it was
small pickings, like, you know, and what, you know, to even think, like, to cover what 8 mares and have what 3 160 horses out of it.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal, you know. I had 4 at the time. The breeder Franz, at the time he died, he just asked, "Would I have a filly that, you know, that maybe you could have to breed?" So that was the 4th one I sent over to him. And you know, one thing I did notice with his young stock was that they actually did get better as older horses. You know, I suppose they were the right type that correct work benefited them and they got stronger. You know, they were made the right way. You know, and I honestly do think that the filly that went over to Franz, that she would have ended up jumping big tracks as well if she had been kept too, you know. But yeah, he didn't get a big number of mares until he was his 7 and 8 year old year.
Yeah.
And then when I say a big number, like, he still, you know, there was no such thing as 150 foals in the ground or anything like that, you know, a year, you know.
Even though you were dealing with the biggest blow, I suppose, to your career and your business, your clarity of mind, in a way, ensured all wasn't lost.
Yeah. At the time, you know, I probably knew 5 days before he died that, you know, the game is up here, you know. So, you know, just to try and salvage something or give yourself options later. When he was put down, whatever semen was in his testicles was harvested. And I took a skin sample that it sounded like Never Never Land at the time, or Dream, that, you know, I'd heard of horses being cloned. And, you know, I thought, you know, I don't know, maybe it gives you the option down the line or something like that. Because, you know, at the time, you didn't have the money. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't actually just do it, you know. But just, it was a punt, and I thought,
for the what if.
Yeah, you know, and just to give you the option, you never know, like, what comes up in life or whatever. Just, you know, but if you didn't do it, you definitely didn't have a chance, you know.
Roll on 10 years.
Yeah.
Where are we now?
I suppose the way to put it, we are very excited at the moment. Because standing out in our yard at the moment, we have the most beautiful 3-year-old clone of Pacino. And it just puts the hair standing on the back of your neck. When you see him, it's just ridiculously uncanny. The similar characteristics you see in him, you know, with silly things. Pacino used to be afraid in doorways, you know. You know, you could wait 5 minutes for him to walk through the door, you know, and it's just, this lad's the same. If you know, you see him looking out across the door, he's the same beautiful head. You know, anytime Pacino walked anywhere, he used to jig jog, you know, and we call the clone AJ. Pacino was always known as Al in the stable, so this is Al Jr., AJ. So he's a beautiful horse. He has unbelievable balance, like the original. He's made like him. He just looks like him. And it's, I have to say, it's just, really, I can't believe that he's there, you know.
That's it. It must, considering that you go from top of the world to losing by far the best horse that you ever had the privilege of riding, to think it's over, that's it, you know, gone. You never, the chances are you're never going to have a horse like him, because those horses don't exist. But to then have, you were fortunate, obviously, you had a lot of success then in the years to follow with some of his offspring, but to actually have him back there Pacino's own stable to greet you every morning.
That was also, it was a difficult journey. I actually did try and clone him back in 2015. And we thought we were going places in 2015 and then got nothing. And then we tried it once more, 2016. And this time we really thought we were going places because there was a mare and she was in foal and she carried nearly her full term, but foaled probably 2 weeks early and it was a disaster. It was a disaster. So, you know, at that stage, you know, there had been so much money spent, the emotional wreck of it as well, and you just threw a line at it, you know. So I thought, you know, that's that.
Yeah.
And then speaking to some people, another opportunity came up probably what, near 4 years ago, and we tried it again, and thank God we did, because, you know, I never dreamt of having him looking over the door again, you know.
And what's special is now 10 years on, you have the benefit of seeing what those offspring went on.
Exactly. I suppose, you know, what do you do when you're starting off with a stallion? What do you look at? You look at his, you know, whether you use him or not. You look at his pedigree first, you know, if he's a young horse. Then you look at his performance, you know. And how far up the level he does perform. But he might have jumped to the highest level. But the next one is, how does he breed? You know, you can have horses jump to the top level but aren't good producers. But, like, the horses that that Pacino produced has been incredible with the amount of numbers that he has had on the ground.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, this was after Pacino had passed or whatever. And no, this was after we've had a few years of producing Pacinos. And I said it to Delith in the yard. I says, God, when these are finished, because at this stage Pacino was gone, I said, when these are finished, I don't know what we're going to do for horses, you know. Because, you know, they were in general good jumpers, but they were all good types. They were nice to work with. They all rode well, good balance. You know, they were good. You know, if they weren't top jumpers, they were really, really good saleable horses, you know. And, you know, he stamped his stock, and it was just, how do you find other types similar to him? And, like, that's probably why for a while there, my numbers actually did drop off in the yard. But, you know, we've a few Pacino mares breeding now, and they've bred very well, you know. So, like, the idea of the clone was to have Pacino offspring again.
Yeah.
It's not to dream about going and jumping
to the Olympics.
Yes, or jumping the Aga Khan, you know what I mean? What I want to see is offspring of Pacino, because obviously I think it'll benefit me, but I do honestly think it'll so benefit the breeders as well. And, you know, I'm just, for the first time in a long time, I have to say I'm excited about the future, you know.
Naturally, when there's breeders listening to this over the years, yourself, your wife Stacey, you've had a variety of people contacting you asking if there's any semen, or, you know, people wondering if it's frozen. Like, I've had people asking me, do I know where you can get any semen? So naturally, when people are hearing this for the first time, they're going to be a few obvious questions. When is he available? How is he available? And what's the stuff he going to be?
The plan is we'll be covering this year. There'll be semen available this year from probably end of March, beginning of April. That's the plan. I'm blessed that Anne-Marie, that looked after Pacino, is also back on board with us. And it's great that, you know, the old team's going to be together again.
Yeah.
And price-wise, he's €1,000. I hope people find that acceptable. I hope he's as lucky for breeders this time as he was the last time.
Having the benefit of hindsight now, 10 plus years on, he got a wide variety of mares. All types and calibre in reality. Yeah. And they've gone on and they've succeeded at a high level in show jumping, right up to the Olympics. They've gone to the World Equestrian Games and eventing with Monbeg by Design. So the mares that he got and that he worked really well with, was there a particular type of mare that you see as the ideal, that you saw that he works best with?
I think, looking back, probably the nice quality mare that maybe wasn't over big or lacked a little bit of power or scope, which in a way probably worked very well with Irish mares, because, you know, a lot of the Irish mares are really good jumpers to a certain level, and they just lack that little bit of range, scope and power. And that's one thing he did add. So it was. So probably, yeah, that mare, that's what, 16 hands, 16-1, maybe a little bit short, seemed to work very, very good. As I say, really give them a bit of range. In general, he gave them with great fronts, really good fronts, and made them in the right way to make them nice to ride. So, it'll be interesting, because you would have loved to have more of them, you know.
Well, now you have every chance. Please, hopefully, we'll be talking another 10 years and you'll have a whole string of Pacinos.
It's possible.
Finally, this is the question that I end each interview with. And typically I ask, what advice would you have to a young breeder or to someone starting off in the breeding program? But as you're a rider, I'd also like to cover, there are young riders around the world that have an interest in breeding that listen to this as well. So if we could first give some advice for the young breeder or the person starting off in breeding, like, what advice would you offer them? And then we'll deal with, how would you advise a young rider trying to make their mark on the industry?
I'm a firm believer that you have to judge the individual that's standing in front of you, no matter what the passport is. So there is a lot of, shall we say, flashy passports around at the moment, but you still need the type, the correct type, to go along with that passport. You know, buying the mare that is, or breeding from the mare that isn't made the right way, even though it might be by a very, very good sire or out of a good mother or that, it still limits you, I think, that the type you're going to get from that mare. So I would say that you need to judge the individual that's standing in front of you as much, or even, you know, get the type that you really like, and then get the passport to suit. But just don't go on the passport on its own, because then, you know, you can end up with just the wrong type, and then the wrong type, not nice to ride, probably doesn't jump, you know. So, you know, really judge what's in front of you, and know what you're looking for. And if you don't know, don't be afraid to go and ask somebody. or get it explained to you, like, you know, why is it the wrong type, you know? So, I you know, people, I don't know whether they're afraid to ask or whatever, but, like, I heard it from a very wise man, every day is a school day, you know, so I'm learning this job as well, you know.
Yeah, and if I think back over the last decade plus, whether it's calling into someone's yard or giving someone a call or going up to talk to someone at the show, it's very, very rare that someone won't give you their time.
Definitely, definitely. And if they don't, well, pass no remarks, go to someone else and yeah. Ask them.
And then in terms of young riders that are out there, ambitious young riders that are, maybe they're setting up their own business or maybe they're getting an opportunity to really up the ante on their own careers, what advice would you give them? Or looking back to yourself as a junior young rider, what advice or what things would you like to have been told at that point in time?
I think that you have to make it work. You have to learn to be a good judge of what you're sitting on. Good and early, because, you know, you get more experience, whatever, you do have a fair idea, even when they're four, where you think, barring accidents, that they should end up. You know, spending your time with a horse that isn't going to end up good enough, it's fine if it's a hobby and it's, you know, it's for fun. But if it's a business, you know, you have to, you know, it's your decisions early on determines what you will earn later on. And the sooner you can sort of start separating the horses, as in where they're going to finish up, is very important. The other thing is too, maybe, like, there's some really good riders at home here, and, like, I do see that as soon as a young rider at the moment shows a bit of ability, the first thing they're thinking of is just get out of Ireland, you know? And, like, they might go to a big name stable, but that big name stable, that rider could be away every week from Wednesday to Sunday. And Monday, he's a bit of office and paperwork to do. You might see him Tuesday before he has to go away Wednesday to the show again, you know? So, like, you have to sort of see where you're going to get the most help from. So, you know, maybe, and this isn't just because I'm based in Ireland or whatever, but maybe you would learn more with a rider that just isn't traveling as much. And, you know, Ireland is a good, like, we are producing a lot of good horses. And on average, on our numbers, I think we're producing as many good horses as any other country. And, like, there's proper horse people in Ireland. And it's also, to be good at this, you have to be a rounded horse person. You know, it's not just about going into the ring. You know, there's so much more to it, you know. And you won't learn it overnight. And so, you know, it's not always about going to the flashiest place or the biggest name to maybe improve your knowledge. So, yeah, Ireland's a good place.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?